creating droplets that are reflecting the sun's rays, so it's actually cooling the planet minusculely.
Why am I not? Oh, here we go. Okay. So we are, in fact, working. Every one of my recordings begins with some incidental remark about how I'm having trouble getting the recorder to work. Okay. Let's see what we've got here. Let me get back to the start page. I debated over whether we should continue in this vein. I think we should. I want to talk a little bit specifically about the period leading up to the Second World War and to the about the Second World War itself. Remember, Hobsbawm is documenting what he argues is a descent into barbarism that has occurred over the course of the 20th century and that is still occurring in the early years of the 21st. That article was written in the waning years of the 20th century, but he's since renewed the argument for the current period as well in subsequent writings.
Hobsbawm.
Did I say Hobsbawm?
Yeah, how old is he?
How old is he? Oh, he's about 85. Yeah, he's not going to be around a whole hell of a lot longer, so enjoy his mind while it's still in existence. But in any event, by barbarism, and traditionally we've been debating this, what the origins of the word are, and I always thought the word originated in the Greeks' inability to understand the language of non-Greek speakers. In other words, when people without the Greek language spoke, they heard them say bar, bar, bar. Right? That's the conventional story anyway. And the idea here is that since they did not possess the Greek language, they also did not enjoy the fruits of Greek civilization. And civilization, of course, referred to all of the products of the city. Now, civis, the word that's at the root, the Latin word that's at the root of civilization, simply means city. Civilized society is one that has an urbanized culture, even if the society itself is not completely urban. Because it's in the cities that, for example, theater is performed, poetry is written, philosophy is conducted, political affairs are conducted, and so forth. So, to be civilized means to inhabit a society that whose culture is dominated by the city. And this was certainly the case for the Greek city-states, and it was also the case for the Roman Empire. Because remember, after all, the Roman Empire is called the Roman Empire, and Rome is a city. And it's the culture of Rome that was spread throughout the world, the known world, when Rome expanded. The barbarians are those people on the edges of civilization, you know, beyond the borders of civilization, that do not participate in the cultural achievements or in the educational achievements of an urbanized society. It's essentially what that means. But, of course, barbarism, the concept of barbarism, got inflected over time to suggest things like the application of brute force. So a civilized person is someone whose upbringing within an urbanized culture has taught him or her how to control their baser impulses. While barbarians, so the argument goes, give leeway. They just give in to their baser impulses. So now the division between civilization and barbarism comes to mean something like the division between people whose orientation is essentially peaceful and well-ordered, and people whose orientation is essentially violent and disordered.
Can you have peaceful barbarians?
Well, not. You see, you have to remember that these are words that were developed by the civilized, right? In other words, what we're getting here is the viewpoint of civilization on the distinction between civilization and non-civilized societies. It wasn't the Germanic tribes, for example, that called themselves barbarians. And if you really look at it carefully, you might want to say that the violence of imperial armies is more barbaric, in a sense, more destructive, because better organized, than the violence of societies that are are subjugated by those empires. Yeah.
I think the part of the reason why barbarism is viewed with more fear and hostility is that organized violence you can at least see coming, so it's not seen as fearful. It's the same idea as using biological weapons. It's not the attack, it's the fear of not knowing when they're going to attack, the randomness.
Yeah. And you're raising a good point here, because the whole image of civilization versus the barbarians is really played upon in the current so-called war against terrorism, right? You know, it's the terrorist organizations who are identified with the barbarians, and the state organizations, especially the ones in the bloc surrounding the U.S., who are seen as harbingers of civilization. Well, however the distinction gets used, and often I guess the message is the distinction is used ideologically, but however the distinction gets used, what Hobsbawm means by it is the following. Enlightenment is civilization is associated in our period with the movements of the Enlightenment, Hobsbawm says. And the Enlightenment, of course, we've talked about quite often in relation to Kant's philosophy. But in general, the Enlightenment is the notion that reason is capable of structuring societies as well as structuring natural science, but structuring societies in such a way that people can dwell with one another peaceably and use that peace, whether it's domestic peace or international peace, to develop their other rational capabilities. So, now, in that respect, barbarism is a retreat from enlightenment, in Hobsbawm's view. Now, often students misread Hobsbawm. They read Barbarism, A User's Guide, as a very dark work, which it is. But they see Hobsbawm as arguing that peace is impossible, or that we have descended to such a level of barbaric behavior that we will never be able to dig our way out. Hobsbawm is a realist in the sense that he wants to look at the situation square in the face without putting any sugar on it, without sugarcoating it. But he does think that it's possible to work our way out of the situation. But for him, we can't work our way out of the situation unless we embrace the values of the Enlightenment. There are several political movements that are often thought to be at odds with one another, that are associated with the Enlightenment and that come out of the Enlightenment. Classical liberalism is one of them, you know, including the liberalism of the founders of the American Constitution. The socialist movement is another one, including the communist movement. Now, you may object to the way in which some of these movements have played themselves out, but Hobsbawm says you have to realize that they were all attempts to create more rational societies by restructuring political and social institutions. If you want an example of a movement in the 20th century that explicitly rejected the values of the Enlightenment, then the clear one is fascism. Now, fascism arose in the interwar period as an explicit rejection of both liberalism and socialism, and of course including its communist version. The fascists rejected both liberalism and socialism, and they rejected in many ways reason itself in favor of what they thought of as more primordial forces, in particular the forces that bind people to a homeland. And not just a homeland, but in the case of German fascism, the forces that bind people to a race. And so fascism takes nationalism and racism and it pushes them to very extreme expressions. Yeah.
Well, a lot of these ideas were actually very popular in psychology.
Sure.
Psychiatry. Dr. Jung, in particular, was a big fan of the Volpich. And
tell people what you mean by Volpich.
Well, the Volk movement revolves around the idea of a sort of a collective unconscious of nations and peoples, that you're like bound together by a sort of an unconscious culture.
Mm-hmm. And you see, that could be somewhat plausible in the old nations of Europe where people did have a shared cultural context. One of the reasons why the fascists were anti-American in general, was because they saw the United States as the negation of that. You know, there is no common culture that binds people together in the United States. We're from all different kinds of cultural backgrounds. And so for the fascists, in the U.S., what we have here is a rootless liberal culture, rather than a culture in which people are bound together by ethnic ties or racial ties or whatnot. Yeah.
Well, it seems like after they threw it off their ethnic ties or racial ties, they began to indulge in their own form of their own culture. Like, for example, the American culture, baseball, apple pie, that kind of ideal. So they didn't necessarily destroy culture altogether. They just formed their own super culture where it didn't matter what race or ethnic group you were.
To a certain extent, that's true. And I think that probably there was a bit of that happening in the early stages of the American Republic, but since the war in particular, since the First World War and even more importantly the Second World War, the media has become the venue for a national culture. So what binds Americans together is not that they have common memories of their hometown or that they have common stories that they're told, it's that they all watch the same television programs. You know, they can all talk about American Idol, or you know, or in a retirement community, they can all talk about what's that show where these are supposed to? Oh, I forget now. What do they love in the retirement communities? I'm forgetting the name of it now. Wheel of Fortune, that kind of thing, right? And so that's what binds us together. But of course, that kind of culture doesn't well up from people's actual connections with one another. It's produced by media corporations, and the purpose of which is to make money and so on.
Still, it's interesting that they'll throw off those cultural ties, start a new life, but then they'll form their other ones. It's like humans naturally gravitate towards wanting to belong to a larger group or set.
Oh, yeah. Spinoza says that as dangerous as people are, and as hateful as they can be, there's always an advantage involved in coming together with them. Because individuals are simply incapable of surviving on their own. You know, we need other people in order to survive. As problematic as social organization is, that's the case. But let's take a little bit of a look at the rise of fascism in the interwar period. Because fascism, as I said, is that movement that explicitly rejects Enlightenment values. There's another movement now, and I don't want to make a facile identification with fascism, but there's another movement on the scene that explicitly rejects Enlightenment values, and that's the various forms of religious fundamentalism that have become politically active and sometimes successfully politically active. So certainly the Islamist regimes, you know, not the Islamic, but the Islamist. Islamism is the political movement that says that the model for a correct political organization is the caliphate that followed Muhammad's death. And so there's an explicit return, an attempt to return to the political structures of about 700 AD.
The Shia,
hold on a second. And there, of course, the notion is that what is corrupting are the liberal values of Western culture. You know, the values that emphasize freedom of expression or freedom of lifestyle. And also, of course, the attempts to disrupt the traditional social order by left-wing movements. You know, both of those are opposed by Islamism. But the same, we have our own correlate of Islamism. We have religious fundamentalism in the United States that's become politically active. In Israel, the fundamentalist Jewish movement is extremely powerful. And in each case, you have an explicit rejection of Enlightenment values. Fascism, however, took this to the extreme. And so what we see here are some images of fascism and its origins. This is the first fascist movement. The first movement that can really be called fascist in the true sense in Europe is Action Française. And Action Française coalesced around the Dreyfus trial. Now, Dreyfus was a Jewish army officer who was accused of treason. Dreyfus's trial was clearly trumped up. He was convicted of treason by a military court that itself was anti-Semitic.
What do you mean by trumped up?
What I mean is that the charges against him were manufactured by his accusers. And the evidence against him was manufactured by his accusers. Dreyfus was sent to Devil's Island, which was the great penal colony, the colonial penal, was it in Guyana? I think it was. French Guyana in the Caribbean. And he was incarcerated there. And his case became very celebrated, in particular because it was taken up by the writer, was it Victor Hugo?
Zola.
Emile Zola. Here's an educated man. Emile Zola, who wrote an article called J'accuse, right? You know, I accused the French government and the French military. And what happened was French society split over the Dreyfus case. And the group that split to the right was Action Française. Action Française, as I said, was explicitly anti-Semitic. It was also monarchist. It wanted to see the abolition of the French Republic and the restoration of the French monarchy. But what made it unique and a pioneering proto-fascist movement was that it organized paramilitary squads and who would go around beating people up, beating political opponents up, beating Jews up, and so forth, and that the presence of the paramilitary squad, in particular in the period leading up to fascist victory, is a central element of fascism. So in Germany, you had the SA, the stormtroopers, organized by the Nazi Party before they came to power. You know, they were used in the same way, to essentially in acts of street violence against political opponents and also against people who were defined as racial opponents. And in Italy, the squadristi, the so-called black shirts, were the equivalent of the squads by the Action Française.
Do they still consider themselves democratic?
No. Democracy is one of those values of the Enlightenment that fascists explicitly reject. And they reject it, and you also see this in Action Française. You see this in their monarchism, but in the case of the more mature fascist movements, you see it in the cult of the leader, right? Their Führer, right? Hitler is, we must subordinate ourselves to El Duce, to Mussolini, or to Der Führer, to Hitler, and part of the whole political ethos of fascism is the cult of the leader.
Yeah, I just don't understand how they could have a political system if they don't want democracy, then what's the point of even having the charade of having something called a Nazi party?
That's a good question, yeah.
Go ahead. Well, the brown shirts kind of got a raw deal, and in return for all of their years of support and brutality, they got fucked. In 1937, Hitler decided that...
See, I've lost complete... all the form in this classroom is gone. Well, you're talking about the SA, the Stormtroopers.
Yes, the SA. Yeah. In 1937, Hitler decided to have their command liquidated.
Yeah, the night of a long night.
Yeah, they came in and they shot absolutely everybody, except for, like, I think one or two war heroes they let out, but they killed tons of people.
Yeah. The SA was a strange organization. It was the most violent wing of the Nazi movement, but in some ways it was also the most... And you have to take this with a grain of salt, the most left-leaning part of the Nazi movement. The SA took at least a part of the language of national, quote-unquote, socialism seriously. And it argued that the Nazi Party ought to, in particular, gear itself or orient itself to benefiting the unemployed workers, of whom there were many in Germany at this time. But one of the reasons why Hitler moved against them in the Night of the Long Knife was not just because they were another source of power within the party that he couldn't control, but that Hitler was in the process of making an alliance with German industrialists who were very nervous about what seemed to be the left-wing rhetoric of the SA. And I've often thought it would be interesting to write a book called The Fascist Left, you know, because it's such an odd locution, but actually within these parties there were elements who pulled in that direction. A number of the members of the Italian Fascist Party were former Italian anarchists who had, and that's, you know, I mean, anarchists are people who reject the state completely. And here what you had was a fairly substantive number of them joining a party that deified the state.
What drew them in?
In part, I guess what drew them in was the fascist emphasis on street action, you know, in mobilizing people in the streets in direct conflict, which, you know, were things that the anarchists were used to. But I think what really drew them in is that a good segment of the Italian anarchist movement became nationalist as a result of the First World War.
So then they weren't anarchists anymore.
They had already made their shift, right. But the issue is, why would nationalism be appealing to them? Because anarchists reject nation states generally as well as the state itself.
Well, maybe they just weren't actually true anarchists, they just wanted to have some tendencies.
Well, I don't know. Italy had a huge anarchist movement. There's no doubt about it. These are some of the pamphlets and so forth that Acción Francés used. Here you see their troops massing. These are, of course, the Tea Party. Marching to the common. I say this tongue-in-cheek. The Tea Party, to me, it's clear that they're not fascists. And the reason why it's clear is that essentially what they have is what we would call a conservative version of Enlightenment values. Right? What they are interested in is limited government, they say, right? Limited government, individual liberty and responsibility. You can't have a fascist movement that's interested in limited government. You know, fascist movements venerate the state. They don't demonize it, which is essentially what happens at the limit in the case of the Tea Party activists.
Well, yes, but this may be true, but at the same time, Republicans have advocated for limited government for years, and yet many of, you know, they have huge blindsides on what government should have limits on.
Sure.
If it comes to, like, bunker-busting nuclear missiles, that's, you know, a go-ahead. If it comes to rounding up potheads and you know...
It all comes back to that with you, doesn't it, Jake?
Oh, yeah.
But you can see, actually, one of the interesting facts about fascism is that it adopts this paramilitary style. So what you have here, these are not people who control the state. They're not members of the French army, and yet they're marching in uniform. You get a sort of quasi-uniforms and military-like formations.
Were these people paid, or were they volunteers?
They were volunteers. There was a great deal of enthusiasm on the part of more conservative sectors of French society for Acción Francés. Anti-Semitism also... I mean, France is an interesting place because there's no doubt that France is one of the most rebellious and left-leaning cultures in the world. It's also true that there are large numbers of quasi-fascists in France. And one of the things that has always powered that in France is a very deep-seated, you know, hard to get rid of anti-Semitism. You know, the French countryside in particular, the French peasantry in particular, and also the French upper classes have been historically anti-Semitic, and it's still the case. And that allows fascist-style organizations to crop up again and again. Now, there's something now, of course, called... Le Pen, the National Front, which is politically active in France and sort of an heir to Acción Francés. I want to move quickly past this so we can get to sort of more developed versions of the phenomenon. Let me move ahead here. Oops, Camelots, yeah. The Camelots were the paramilitary troops that Acción Francés controlled. They also set up, in some cases, trade unions under their auspices. Okay, let's see here. Oh boy, I spent a lot of time on Acción Francés. Okay, let's get to the first movement that explicitly called itself fascist, and that's the Italian fascist movement under Mussolini. What seems to have happened in Italy as well as in Germany is that the experience of World War I changed the domestic culture tremendously. So, in particular, there was an anti-war sentiment in the aftermath of World War I, but there was also a very strong pro-war sentiment. And there were men who had fought in World War I who missed it. Well, because these were people who had very little in the way of prospects in the outside world. And in the act of actually of fighting in the Second World, in the First World War, they were at the center of history, the center of events. You know, newspapers were covering their actions. They were able to leave the boredom of repetitive, low-level jobs for work that, after all, may have been dangerous and arduous, but at least was exciting.
It seems like they almost romanticized the idea of fighting on the front lines. Even though you may die, you'll be seen as a hero, you'll be given praise. And they didn't really give these people much to do except fighting.
Yeah, exactly. There was a cult of the hero and a cult of a veneration of courage in the face of violence, the willingness to exercise violence in behalf of one's beliefs, and so forth. It all played into this period. And many of the leaders of the fascist movement were World War I veterans. And so here, I've talked about this before, the word fascism comes from this symbol of the Roman Empire, the fasces, which is a series of axes bound together on stalks of wheat. This was, as I said, it was a symbol that was carried by the lictors, who were political attachés in the attached to the French legions. And it would identify them as representing the power of Rome. Now here we see some of the early fascist newspapers. And who is this? Anybody recognize him? This is a young Benito Mussolini. Yeah, this is the fellow. And Mussolini is a classic example of what happened in some cases during the war. Mussolini was a socialist in his early years, and he actually was the editor of the Socialist Party newspaper. And then under the impact of the First World War, he moved from socialism to an extreme form of Italian nationalism. And then after the war, began organizing a political party and a set of paramilitary organizations that powered him ultimately got him into power in Rome in the early 20s. So here you see a fascist broadside, a pamphlet with the Roman fasces. And of course, what the adoption of the symbol the fasces did was it associated Mussolini's party with an explicit attempt to revive the Roman Empire on a new foundation. Here's Mussolini in the upper left corner addressing the crowd. And you can see another aspect of fascist politics, and I think this is why some people are misled into thinking that the Tea Party people are fascists, and that is that fascist politics is mass-based. It involves, especially in its early stages, mass mobilizations. You know, getting thousands of people into the streets, or thousands of people onto the Boston Common. And of course, this is why I think that people are misled about the Tea Party, because the Tea Party people are also mass mobilizers. You know, they bring out hundreds or thousands of people to events, but I think for very different purposes. Here you see one of the fascist squads, the Squadristi. And it says, ridiculing an Italian politician.
One thing I don't understand about Italian fascism is I heard a lot of the people in Italy didn't want to actually fight, at least in World War II. They would throw down their arms a little bit.
Well, I think this is exaggerated. You know, it's as exaggerated as the French, as the image of the French as being incapable of fighting. What is true is that the Italians did not fight effectively. And as they were defeated, of course, the number of surrenders increased, especially toward the end of the war. But that has to do more with the traditional weaknesses of the Italian state, I think, than it does with the cowardice of the Italians.
I was saying cowardice. I'm saying that they may have not actually wanted to.
Well, they certainly, at least large numbers, certainly were energized by militarist and nationalist rhetoric. You know, I'm hearing you saying some of the magazines that the fascists put out. They also had, unlike the German fascist movement, the Italians had avant-garde artists involved. And in particular, a form of art called Futurism was associated with the Italian fascist movement. Marinetti, who was the leader of that, was an explicit fascist. There's Mussolini. But the political poster, the you know, the mass circulation magazine, the mass circulation newspaper, the thousands of people in the streets, the cult of the leader, and the use of paramilitary squads all sort of collectively define the phenomenon. One of the interesting things about Italian fascism was that until the very end of the war, while it was nationalist, it was not really explicitly racist. You know, racism was a phenomenon of the German fascist movement, of the Nazi movement. And, for example, in the early stages, a good number of Italian Jews were members of the Fascist Party. There's actually a very good movie about this called The Garden of the Finzi Continis. It was done by a superb Italian director, Vittorio De Sica. And what it shows is a family, a wealthy family of Italian Jews who become members of the Fascist Party and then are expelled because of Mussolini's alliance with Hitler. And that's what put pressure on Mussolini to purify the Italian Fascist Party of Jews. And then ultimately, they're shipped off to concentration camps. And this also happened, and it was as a result of pressure by Hitler that Mussolini, toward the end of the fascist regime, began to participate in the so-called Final Solution. And here are the two great fascist leaders of Europe, of course, that's Hitler and Mussolini. Mussolini was the first, Hitler was the second. Hitler explicitly adopted Mussolini's style and Mussolini's politics, but gave it, if anything, an even more extreme formulation, and in particular, you know, by inflecting it through anti-Semitism. Both Italian fascism and German fascism were vehemently anti-communist. And at the beginnings of the movement, there were great battles between the communist parties of Italy and the German and the fascist party of Italy and the Nazi party. But of course, the fascists in those two countries prevailed. And their first act was to make the communist parties illegal. Il Duce. Oh, and once again, remember, the open-hand salute, which Mussolini revived, was the symbol, was the way in which Roman soldiers greeted one another, and also Roman politicians greeted one another in the classical Roman Empire. There's a Mussolini, the man of the people, harvesting, working on the harvest for the cameras, of course. The Pact of Steel between Hitler and Mussolini. Of course, it was this alliance that ultimately led to the Second World War. It's hard to believe anybody could take Mussolini seriously.
It's like a cartoon character.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like an operatic character, right? But I've heard, remember, in organizing this exhibition, one of the branches of the exhibition was to take place in Italy, and that fell apart. And so the woman who organized an exhibition in Holland asked me why the Italians had pulled out. And I said there was some internal drama, some split between, you know, two of the Italian organizers. And she said to me, "I asked the Italians. It's always an operetta." Even today. Yeah, and Hitler and Mussolini were often posed with children. And here, what you see is the beginnings of the end of the fascist movement. Let's see here. I found a lot of photos, didn't I?
I heard the Mafia allied with America to take out Mussolini or something.
I'm not sure about that, but I do know that the U.S. was allied with the Mafia in its attempt to crush the communist movement after the end of the Second World War, which it failed to do. Actually, the Italian Communist Party was the biggest vote getter in Italy for about 30 years after the war. I really did fun stuff, didn't I? Okay, here we go. Jeez, I'm getting sick of them now. I'm going past Mussolini. Come on. That's enough of Mussolini. My God. Oh, I love this one. Somebody was talking about... No, it was you, James, wasn't it? The heroic feel to the First World War aviator. Yeah, well, Mussolini was an amateur aviator. And this contributed to his charisma.
When the Nazis busted him out of prison, they came in with commandos
on airplanes. Oh, yeah. Okay, we are moving fast now. Come on, let's get out of here. Let's get to the Germans, because, like I said, with the Germans, you had the most extreme expression. Boy, I really did. Really went overboard here. Are you getting all these images? Are they coming to you subliminally?
They will.
Okay. All right, here we go. By the way, Mussolini was captured by partisans when the Allies invaded, and he was killed.
Strung up on a meat hook,
and here you see the body. It's a pretty gruesome image. But, you know, now think about this. You know, Hobsbawm's argument is that the rise of the fascist movement played a role in the continued descent into barbarism. Here you have anti-fascists who are engaging in a pretty barbaric kind of violence. And I think this is part of Hobsbawm's point, is that people, even people who associated themselves with Enlightenment values, tended to fall to the level of their opponents as a result of the great violence of the First and the Second World Wars. The Nazi movement, as I said, of course, this is the most extreme version of fascism that came to power in the interwar period. And here you see a young Hitler. Hitler himself... here you see, this is the art school that Hitler was futilely trying to get into in Berlin. Hitler, I think everybody knows, was a disenchanted and unrecognized painter. He was not a great modern artist, but he was by no means completely talentless. He painted, street scenes and things like that, and it was fairly okay. But he was never able to get into the premier art school in Vienna, which is where he was at the time, and this was a great source of pain for him, and also a great source, font of revenge for him. He felt that he had been excluded by the cultural elite.
Well, he didn't finish high school.
Yeah. So what?
Well, they said that his drawings would have been adequate for architecture school. They were too flat.
But he couldn't get in because...
He couldn't get into architecture school because he didn't have high school diploma.
You know too much for this class.
Why did he drop out?
Let me continue here a little bit. This is Adolf here. Where is he? This is him. As a World War I soldier. And so Hitler himself was an archetypal example of the World War I veteran who missed the action of World War I when the war was over with. And in part, the creation of the Nazi Party and of the SA and so forth. This was an early party meeting in one of the great beer halls of Germany. Munich, yeah. These are some of the associated. This is, I believe this is Himmler.
Did he mention those names in Austria, or was it Germany?
The Nazi movement spanned the two. And eventually, Hitler wound up in Berlin, and in Munich and in Berlin, but he started off in Austria. Yeah. He started off in Austria, and one of the first claims that the Nazis made when they came to power was of the annexation of Austria. It's called Auschwitz. Here you're saying the man himself. Let me go on here. Strasser was the leader of the stormtroopers of the SA, and this was one of the fellows who was assassinated by Hitler's SS in the Night of the Long Knife. You know, the SS essentially did in the SA, the stormtroopers, and then they became the main police wing, police paramilitary wing of the Nazi state. Some theorists think that what characterizes fascism as a movement is that it relies upon the police as the linchpin of domestic political power. It's the domestic police apparatus, and in particular the national police apparatus, that is the ultimate mainstay of support for the fascist governments, and for example, not the military.
So I'm guessing they didn't give out parking tickets.
And you know, I mean, here you see some of the imagery of German Nazism. This is, of course, the racially pure Aryans. The Aryan race has been polluted by foreign elements, in particular by Slavs and Gypsies and Jews. It must be purified. Laws were passed granting citizenship only to, allowing the... Laws were passed mandating the purging of citizenship or the removal of citizenship from people who were not pure Aryans. This is classical totalitarian architecture, which was an attempt really to recreate something like Rome, but on a much grander scale and a much more mechanically regularized scale, I guess is the best way to put it. Once again, we have the German woman. Eugenic measures were taken to purify the race. Aryan women were encouraged to have as many babies as possible. That was the way in which Aryan women did their duty to the Reich, and so forth. There were mass rallies as a part of Nazism. And then, of course, probably the most identifiable part of it, and that is the anti-Semitic element, which led ultimately to the rounding up of Jews and the creation of the concentration camps and then of the death camps. I think, let me get down here to, since we have limited time. Here you see some of the mass rallies and also the, this looks like a dramatization of the death of Hitler. You know the story, right? Hitler was in the bunker in Berlin.
I just loved the bunker, though.
Because of his windows?
Yeah.
Well, maybe. Certainly looks like there are two figures here.
Yeah.
No. You know what? This can't be right. There's a third figure. There are only two involved in the suicide of Hitler. Well, in any event, the story was that Hitler was in the bunker with his chief military officers, a number of advisors, and his long-term mistress, Eva Braun, and it became clear that the Allies and the Russians were about to converge on Berlin. Hitler would have been arrested, tried at Nuremberg, and then publicly executed, which is something that he didn't want. And so he and Eva Braun took poison. Cyanide pills, yeah, and died as a result, along with a good number of his upper echelon figures. But here, let me get down to the very final scene. No, I guess I didn't do it. I guess it doesn't come up here. There's a scene that I wanted to show you which shows the Soviet flag flying over the Reichstag when the Russians came into Berlin. And the reason why I think it's an interesting image is that that, of course, was the nightmare that Hitler had, that German society would be taken over by the German Communist Party. And ironically, you know, it was his own efforts that facilitated that. If there had been no Second World War, undoubtedly the German communists would not have prevailed, but they did in half of Germany. Okay, we're going to continue next time. We'll get off of Habermas. I'll conclude with a few comments And please read Hobsbawm's piece, what is it called? Constitution for a Pluralist World Society.
The one that's like 40 pages. It's pretty short. It's
I think the guy who flew one of the Soviet flags recently died. I read it in an article.
Oh, is that right?
He died at like 90-something.
Yeah.
It's pretty weird.
Yeah.
Apparently the original one, they couldn't put it up because German snipers kept shooting it down, so they put up a cloth flag originally and then posed for that other picture.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, here's some more things about the image of the flag being put up in here in, what was it, Guadalcanal? You know the one where
maybe Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima, that's where it was. Yeah, that was posed, right?
Yeah. You can't do that during gunfire.
Yeah, it's hard to do that during fire, right?
Pretty sure it's after the
battle. Yeah, yeah, you're right. Can you turn on the lights, please? Thank you.
How is it possible for idiots to pay all these people? And how is it possible to trust? You know.
Say again.
How is it possible for Hitler to trust, you know?
Oh, he did it.
Because he could have been captured any time.
That's why he would randomly kill his officers.
Oh, yeah. He was completely paranoid, but paranoid with good reason. You remember at the end of the war, there was the officers' coup, and they actually planted a bomb in a room that Hitler was speaking in, but there was a metal barrier between Hitler and the bomb, and it saved Hitler's life. And in the aftermath, he slaughtered, I guess, hundreds of people. And it seems that Rommel, the very popular tank commander, was one of the people who was slated to be executed by Hitler. And the theory is that Rommel committed suicide to prevent that from happening. He died in a tank accident, but the theory was that it was engineered by Rommel. Yeah.
Was it a hard job for him, you know?
I'm sorry?
Was it easy for him?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Exactly.
And then this is one of the points that Spinoza makes. Spinoza is really an excellent theorist. I think I'm going to include him in the next version of this class. He makes the point that regimes that try to control every little aspect of people's lives are not destined to last very long.
That's true.
Yeah. Papa Doc.
Right? I heard Baby Doc, before, where if you have money, you'll be able to deposit it into Swiss banks.
Right.
So I heard there's a case going on the Swiss. So much, I believe 8 million.
I have no doubt.
Yeah. You're going to turn that money over to the 80s. So.
Now, where is he now?
He's in France. Yeah.
He's in France.
Yeah.
The French gave him political immunity. They accepted him as an exile.
Asylum,
yeah. Yeah, that's odd, you know?
He took tons of money. His wife is not, she's not with him anymore.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I remember when Baby Doc fled.
Yeah.
People were
people should go back. Yeah.
People were tracking down the Tonton Macoute.
Yeah.
There was the burning tires and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it was followed, unfortunately.
In Tonton Macoute, one of my sister, my mom's sister,